Cam setting up and in, 2-2. Swing and a miss. He got him on strikes.
Oh, man, another outstanding pitch.
11 strikeout for Daniel Norris, and every single strikeout on a swinging third strike. The 1-2. Swing the line drive down the left field line, hooking toward the corner. That is a fair ball. Rounding second, heading to third is Romine. Clark waving him around third. Relay to the plate from the outfield. Slide. Save. Tigers tie it up. The 3-2. Fly ball, right center field, hit it hard, got a chance, score!
Wow.
Miguel Cabrera, number 32, and the Tigers take a 4-2 lead in the eighth. First pitch, swinging a soft tapper to short. Charging Iglesias, has to hurry. Fields throws, got him at first, Tigers win.
Well, I mean, he's not going to start during the regular season, so we know that. And I think we probably already knew that. Getting the news that we did is probably pretty damn good. It's musculature as opposed to something with a ligament or, you know, the repair that was already in there. So they'll give him the PRP injection to try to speed up the recovery, let him rest for a period of days, then start to ramp him back up. If we're fortunate enough to keep playing and we ramp him back up, good. You know, there's no reason to even speculate. Like I said, the one thing we want to do is get him healthy, make sure he knows he's healthy, because that's important. And then if it fits somewhere, good. But the biggest thing is to get him healthy. I don't think they need to try to do more than they can. Every time they start, it's a big night. Every time somebody does well, it helps everybody. But it's always a case. Guys can't be something they're not. You start trying to pitch for you and somebody else, that makes it harder. They just need to do their thing, and we'll be okay.
Hey, somebody has run out on the field. Some goofball in a hat and a red shirt. Now he takes off the shirt. He's running down the middle by the 50. He's at the 30. He's bare-chested and banging his chest. Now he runs the opposite way. He runs at the 50. He runs at the 40. The guy is drunk, but there he goes. The 20. They're chasing him. They're not going to get him. Waving his arms, bare-chested. Somebody stop
that
man.
Look out. Here comes the blue coat.
Oh, they got him.
Here comes the blue
coat. They're coming from the left. Oh, and they tackle him at the 40-yard line. That was the most exciting thing to happen tonight.
I tell you what, that was a great call on your part.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
What an unbelievable night of football action on Monday night. The first Monday night action of the season, and we get a couple of outstanding efforts. One from the Pittsburgh Steelers in completely dismantling the Washington Redskins, and one from Kevin Harlan. What a call on Westwood One, which means what a call right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. The drunk dude was easily, without question, the most exciting play and the most exciting player in the game between the 49ers and the new Los Angeles Rams, without any question. That was epic. So thank you so much to Kevin Harlan for providing something worth watching and or listening to in that game last.
He's running down the middle by the 50. He's at the 30. He's bare-chested and banging his chest. Now he runs the opposite way. He runs at the 50. He runs at the 40. The guy is drunk, but there he goes. The 20. They're chasing him. They're not going to get him. Waving his arms, bare-chested. Somebody stop that man.
Here comes the blue coat.
Oh, they got him.
They're
coming from the left. Oh, and they tackle him at the 40-yard line.
So detailed. Such a great lesson for would-be broadcasters coming up.
I tell you what, that was a great call on your part. That was a great call. All right, I'm ready for the last 11:31 now, Kevin. Let's go.
Look at the police. They've surrounded this man like he is... Like he's just robbed a bank.
I tell you what, he got a whole lap in
he
before
did,
they
yes.
got him. I mean, that was pretty good. I expected him to go down much sooner.
Yeah. But... I hope it was worth it, my friend, because you've got a night in the clink coming up.
Oh, what a classic, classic moment in broadcasting. Kushlin, I think I heard you say what a great lesson for broadcasters, and I think that's very, very true. Kevin Harlan calling it play-by-play, being your eyes, since you can only use your ears on a radio call, being your eyes telling you exactly what you would be seeing. The only thing I think he missed is a couple of calls on the, you know, he said, he's at the 20, he's at the 10, and then the guy circles back to go the other way. You know, the only thing missing was, he suddenly cuts back! He goes against the grain! They still can't catch him! And even better, yeah, to the 20, to the 10, and then to the 15, to the 20, back out to the 25 before they finally got him. Oh, but the best part was he's drunk and they're not going to go. I loved every single second of that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, honestly, that was a painful game for anybody who stayed up late. I didn't stay up for much of it. I didn't hear that live, obviously. That was around 1 o'clock in the morning, wasn't it, Jim?
Yeah, that was about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, so I wasn't up for that. I had too much morning work to get done before I could go, before I could stay up that late for something like that. But I'm so glad that I heard it this morning, and I'm so glad he did it, because as I looked back at that game and I saw some of the passing statistics and I saw some of the overall stats and the lack thereof by the putrid, and I do mean putrid, Los Angeles Rams, against a rebuilding Chip Kelly-led, Blaine Gabbert quarterbacked, Colin Kaepernick disgracing San Francisco 49ers squad that suddenly looked like a world championship team because of how bad the Rams are. In a game like that, you needed some kind of entertainment, and at least Kevin Harlan provided that on Monday night, week number one, Kush.
Yeah, absolutely no doubt about it. And like I said, that is a great lesson for up-and-coming broadcasters. It reminds me of one time I got to ask a former Cavs broadcast radio play-by-play guy, Joe Tate. I got to ask him the question, because the story had always went that at the time when the Guns were owning the team, when Gordon Gunn owned the team, and he being blind and everything, he said, my job is you have to describe it so I can be his eyes. You have to be able to be so detailed as best you can, because you're somebody's eyes for that one. And that's why that entire call, as hilarious of the circumstances it was, is a great lesson, because that's how it's done, especially on a radio broadcast. I'm sure it sounded nowhere near as fun on the TV side of things, because of course they don't even show the guy running on camera because they want to discourage.
There was a little bit of it,
that.
Though. There was a little bit, because I've seen some of the video.
Yes, a little bit.
Yeah, I've seen some of it on TV today, and I've seen some of it online. They try to discourage that. And which, by the way, wow. What a great point you just made, because it drops right into my Colin Kaepernick take of the day. And it's going to be this. It's my last Colin Kaepernick take of the day, and if not of forever. I've decided, look, we need to treat Colin Kaepernick and anybody else that's doing this, hey, I'm going to disrespect the flag and anthem crap that's been going on. We need to treat them the same way we treat that guy, the drunk guy on the field last night. We need to treat them the same way we treat the streaker guy who goes across the field in a bodysuit or in a thong or in nothing. We need to treat these people like they treated the two idiots who rushed Ryan Lochte on the Dancing with the Stars stage last night. Did you hear about that, Jim?
No, because I don't watch those shows, but now I do.
Well, you don't need to watch it to hear the story. The story is Ryan Lochte, because I don't watch it either, but I heard about it this morning.
Right.
He's the disgraced, American swimmer lying in Rio, blah, blah, blah. He's doing this, and apparently a couple of people who don't like him at all. Maybe it's a personal thing, or maybe it's just over this recent, Rio mishap with the Olympics. But they rushed him on the stage, and the camera stayed focused on the judges the entire time.
Yep.
Even though the judge didn't have anything more to say because she was watching the action, you could hear, what was going on off stage, or off camera, I should say. And, finally the host, Tom Bergeron, says, we're going to take a time out right now and come right back while we deal with this situation, or something like that, a professional way. And then when he comes back, they ask Lochte how he felt about it. And he said he admitted he was a little shook up by it or a little upset by it or something like that. But, it is what it is. So they kept the cameras on the judges. So here's my point. What is Colin Kaepernick? What was Brandon Marshall Thursday night? What were those Dolphins players on Sunday? What were these individuals who continue to disrespect the flag in a misguided, ignorant, naive protest of something they have no earthly idea or understand? What are they? They are attention whores. That's what they want. They are attention whores. They crave attention. That's all they want, is cameras on them. And when the cameras go on them, then what do? Then they retweet themselves all over the place. They retweet one another all over the place to say, see, it's growing. They are attention whores. To me, the camera operators, the directors of the broadcast need to do the same thing. When the anthem is playing, show the flag. Show the crowd. Show the players standing at attention with their hands on their heart. Show the field. Show the wide shot from the blimp. Show everything except for the attention whores. Deny them what they seek, which is attention, and watch and see what happens. You know what will happen? They will fade away faster than Colin Kaepernick's career.
Now, there's some truth to that because, you know, if you think back to the beginning of this whole thing a couple weeks ago in the preseason, the one preseason game where the cameras caught him, that was the second game as we, you know, came to find out that he was doing that. So that means there was a preseason game, no camera was on him, so nobody even knew he was doing it.
Third, actually.
Oh, you're right. You're right. It was the third game.
Yeah. He did it for the first two, but nobody was paying attention.
Nobody knows
to him.
Because there wasn't a camera on him that,
exactly.
that caught
him. And
then
it. Somebody caught him in the third one and said, what's this all about? And then, bang, he got what he wanted was attention. And that's exactly, you know, where it is today. And all of those high school kids, I told you about this. Did we get into this yesterday, Jim?
You brought it up, but we didn't get in depth into it.
There are a bunch of teams in different pockets of the country, one in Camden, New Jersey, one in Norfolk, Virginia, one in Louisville, Kentucky, one somewhere in Indiana, and one somewhere else. But there's a handful of players or teams from around the country that have decided to join in, these high school kids. You know, I mean, this is what they do. You know, these kids that don't know any better. They try to dress like their favorite NFL players, right? They try to wear their gloves like they do, you know, with the Velcro undone. They try to wear the same visors. They try to wear the same, you know, wristbands and bicep bands and all this stuff. They want to look like them. They try to talk like them. They try to mimic their moves. They try to catch balls one-handed like Odell Beckham Jr. They want to do what their idols do, right? So they're doing the same thing here. They're emulating these NFL players and their ridiculous let's not honor the anthem or the flag protests, even though they don't have a clue as to what in the living H they're doing. Not a clue. Not word one of understanding of what it is that they are supposedly protesting. And yet they're doing it to emulate the heroes. And then so Kaepernick, you know what he was doing all weekend? He was retweeting any pics that there were of high school kids doing this. And congratulating them, giving them what? What they wanted. They're 15 minutes of fame. Colin Kaepernick's got 945,000 Twitter followers. That's nearly a million if you're scoring at home. And these kids are like, man, I'm going to get myself retweeted by Cap to a million people. I'm going to get my own, you know, personal 15 minutes of fame here as they emulate their little heroes. So to me, you ignore Colin Kaepernick. You ignore every single one of them that were doing this nonsense. Watch and see how fast it fades away until they find some other more aggressive stunt that's going to be paid attention to. So I am kind of going to try. Look, I'm human. I'm human, and I'm fallible, and I'm going to make mistakes sometimes. So I can't sit here and swear that I'm going to never ever talk about this Kaepernick story again, because if he does something really crazy or something, you know, breaks out on the sideline or something stupid happens, I will of course be forced to talk about it. And I may just make a mistake and one day get overwhelmed with feelings about it, because I take great pride in my country, my flag, the national anthem, the people who died and bled to protect all of the above. I take great, great pride in those things. And so I might get overwhelmed and talk about it again at another time. But I'm telling you, my goal, it's not my promise, it's my goal, is to not talk about these people anymore. I want Kaepernick to fade away. I want Kaepernick to fade away faster than his throwing ability did, faster than his career did. He goes from the Super Bowl 4 years ago to being a backup behind Blaine Bleeping Gabbert right now in San Francisco. So he is nothing to even factor in anymore as a player. He doesn't deserve the attention he's getting, and nor do his acolytes or followers around the league. So I am beseeching other talk show hosts, and we listen to one another. I mean, make no mistake about it. I listen to ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, but I listen to some other stations. I listen to some national shows. I read other people's thoughts. I read Twitter, follow other hosts. I'm beseeching my fellow talk show hosts not to pay any attention anymore to the attention whores. That's all they want. You deny them what they want, which is attention, and they will fade away into what Mike Tyson once lovingly called Bolivian. That's what I want to see happen in this situation.
Well, and I'll start that up because, you know, we're talking football things, and we start with that great Kevin Harlan call. And
which call? This one?
Yeah. Is it that one?
Hey, somebody has run out on the field. Some goofball in a hat and a red shirt. Now he takes off the shirt.
This will not get old anytime soon.
He's at the 30. He's bare-chested and
banging his chest. Now he runs the opposite way. He runs at the 50. He runs at the 40. The guy is drunk, but there he goes. The 20. They're chasing him. They're not going to get him.
A sudden
waving
cutback.
His arms, bare-chested. Somebody stop
Look
that
out.
Man.
Here comes the blue coat,
Oh,
Kevin.
They got him.
Here comes
They're coming
the
from the
coat.
Left. Oh, and they tackle him at the 40-yard line.
I like the excitement. Oh, and they tackle him at the 40-yard line.
I mean, as if it was a third-down play in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl. You know? They got him at the 40-yard line.
That's why it's such an instructive call for wannabe broadcasters in the future. Even though that's a drunk fan on the field, it sounds like a weird football play almost.
Yes, indeed.
Because that's how
indeed
the pros do it. But, you know, think of something you mentioned earlier about, and it was about Kaepernick, but you mentioned about passing things. And, Bob, I'm in a little bit of a conundrum that I need you to help me out with.
I love conundrums.
And part of it is because, the Rams were so awful.
Yes,
you know, yesterday it was just so ugly for anyone who decided, and I feel for you right now if you stayed up and watched that thing. But earlier today, the guys on Dan Lebatard's show here on the Ticket were talking about in relation to how bad those games were, and I do mean plural. The Steelers kind of looked awesome, but otherwise that game was kind of a snooze fest at the end too because they
because
blew
well
up.
it was because it was one sided,
right.
But the Steelers were so entertaining
yes.
in it. I mean, Antonio Brown got a 15-yarder
yes.
for twerking in
know.
The end zone.
No,
who twerks in the end zone? Come on, AB. You're twerking in the end zone for crying out loud. And you know what, Jim?
Yeah.
He was way too good at it.
Yeah.
He looked like, which means he has not, he was not a twerking rookie. He wasn't a twerky. He was not.
Right.
He was not
well,
a
like
rookie
that.
Twerker. He was not a rooker. He has done this before. He moved those hips so I don't even know what the adjective would be here.
Right.
Or the adverb would be. I don't know how to describe his twerking, but you could tell he had done it before. He looked like he was in Sir Mix-a-Lot's video.
Yes.
He does. I swear to God. All he was missing was the hot pants with the thong for Baby Got Back, but he has done it before, and he got a 15-yarder, they said, for sexually suggestive moves in the end zone.
Oh, Lord.
And I got to tell you, when I first saw it, I said, how is his dance any different than, you know, a lot of other dances that people do? He didn't use a prop. He didn't use the goalpost. He didn't go to the ground, which, of course, are all finable offenses. What did he do? But then when they said it was sexually suggestive, I said, okay, yeah, it probably was, and it was probably right to go ahead and flag him for that. 15 yards on Antonio Brown. Anyway, watching him play and watching Roethlisberger and the Steelers without three of their best players last night, very, very entertaining football team. So I know I got in the way of what you were trying to say.
No, no, it's actually okay that you brought up how entertaining the Steelers were, because what they were talking about in Lebatard's show, and it fascinated me a little bit, so much so that I had to look up some numbers on this, because you take out that, and what you're seeing a lot, as we know, in the NFL, is a lot of dinking and dunking and things like that, right, from your passing game.
Right.
And they threw out a number, which is not correct because he did not have enough, I guess, games played last year to qualify. It's kind of like ERA.
Right.
But my conundrum, Bob, is because of that style and some of the things we're seeing, you know, in this evolving NFL passing game, is completion percentage really that good of a barometer? Or is it on its way to becoming the win stat of football? Here's what I mean by that. Do you know who the league leader last season in completion percentage was for quarterbacks?
No.
Kirk Cousins.
Okay.
At 69.8. Kirk Cousins. He's awful. He completed so many because he's always checking down for 3 yards. Do you know who is second? And this is the mistake they made. They said he was first, but he's not listed amongst last year's leaders because I don't think he played enough games to qualify, kind of like an ERA in baseball or batting average.
Who's that?
69.3% completions last season for, drumroll please, Brandon Whedon. That right there, when I heard that,
you already disqualified. But Jim, you already disqualified that stat by your pointing out that he didn't have very many attempts.
True.
Your Cousins one is a better example, but I will still respond in the negative to your question.
Okay.
as to whether or not it's become like the baseball win stat. Because the win stat is still an important stat. It's just that there is too much emphasis placed upon it. To get a win, you need to go at least five innings.
Right.
You need to actually do some things. And then, of course, or if you're a starter, I mean, or just be in the game when the winning run is scored. If you're a reliever, it still matters. To me, it's not as important as ERA. It's not as important as walks and hits per inning pitched, strikeout to walk ratio, all that stuff. But it is a factor. It is a good factor. And I will say this, that the completion percentage is just one of many very important factors. If you're completing half your passes, if you're throwing 30 and completing 15, you're just done. It matters, Jim. You really do have to complete a good percentage. But if you're doing it for, like you said, less than 3 yards an attempt, or if you're doing it, having a high completion percentage, but you're not beating teams because you're not getting the ball in the end zone, now it's an overrated statistic. And I think that's the case with Cousins. Now, I'll tell you this, it's coincidental, because you and I did not plan this out when we talked pre-show.
Right.
But I saw a stat on Kirk Cousins earlier today that was very important to me because, you know, watching Roethlisberger take apart the Redskins yesterday, Kirk Cousins just got a massive contract to be the quote-unquote franchise guy. We're examining what does it mean to be a franchise guy? Roethlisberger's a franchise quarterback. Kirk Cousins, is he really? Well, based on that breakout year he had last year, you might say, yeah, he is, and including the stat you just gave me. But here's the real value, or here's evidence of the real value or lack of value in that stat. Kirk Cousins against teams with winning records last year, teams that finished over 500, was 0-5. He threw 4 touchdowns in those 5 games, 6 picks. His completion percentage was a little over 50 or 52%. I don't have it memorized right now. I saw it earlier today. And his yards per attempt and his yards per completion were way down. In other words, he got fat on his numbers against a bunch of bad teams. But when Washington played teams that were winning teams, forget about it. He was awful and they were awful. So if you look at it in those terms, the completion percentage stat is completely irrelevant. But if you look at it in a bigger picture sense, it is relevant, just not on its own. You've got to combine it with yards per attempt.
Okay.
You got to combine it with third down proficiency too. Third down throws. What's your completion percentage on third down throws? You got to combine it with touchdowns to interceptions, and obviously whether you win or not in those games in which you have high completion percentage. So it matters. And congratulations to Kirk Cousins. But at the end of the day, if that's the only thing you got going for and those other stats are nothing to you, then it really doesn't matter.
And for perspective, he went 30 of 43, so that's 69.8% completions yesterday for Kirk Cousins. But we know how that game turned out.
Exactly. Well, and they were never in it.
Exactly. So I appreciate you talking to me a little off the ledge because I heard that this morning. They're talking 69% for Cousins, and even Brandon Weeden did part time. I'm thinking, wait a minute, I gotta look this up, because if all this is true, then maybe I have to reevaluate how much stock I put in completion percentage, because I didn't even realize that.
Put a little bit of stock into it, but just not too much.
Okay.
Like I said, look at Roethlisberger. Roethlisberger, of course, played a much, much, much better game, a much more efficient game. What did he have? He was 27 of 37. That's actually 73%, so 4 percentage points better, but 3 touchdowns, 1 interception, mm-hmm. 112 quarterback rating, 300 yards, yards per attempt was higher, all of those things. So, yeah, completion percentage matters when taken as a factor in a complete evaluative stat line. But to just say that guy is a great quarterback because he completes a lot of passes or a high percentage of them is obviously misleading. I can complete 9 out of 10 screen passes probably, and 90% completion isn't going to make me a decent quarterback.
Good call. Okay.
So let's leave that there. I know we've got Bill Landis waiting in the wings to talk college football, but I want to take this call from Rob in Toledo before we go to the bottom of the hour break, because Rob wants to talk about this Kaepernick story and my idea to basically turn away. Do not put the cameras on these guys. Let them fade away with their little silent protests and see where it goes from there. Rob, go ahead. You're on the air.
I got a question for you. You keep saying that this is about getting attention.
Yeah.
I guess I'd like to know why you think Jim Brown and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar are coming out and supporting what he's doing. And I guess my take
your
on
phone
it
cut
is
out.
Whether,
your phone, hold whether, on, Rob, your phone cut out there. I heard you say what Jabbar is doing, and then your phone cut out. I didn't hear that part.
Well, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Jim Brown have come out in support of what Kaepernick has done. Clearly, they're not doing it because they want attention. So whether you agree with whether or not his cause is right or wrong, he clearly is doing it for a cause. And the people coming out and supporting him are doing it because they feel that there is a reason to do it other than just attention. Now, you can
say there's two reasons why his cause isn't real. Yeah, well, the cause is a joke. The cause is a joke, and they're frauds, 100% fraudulent. If they cared at all,
there is no racial inequality.
There is no cause that they believe in. There is no cause that they believe in. Colin Kaepernick is a puppet on the strings of Black Lives Matter, which is a fraudulent group that is out to make money. No, I'm just telling you the truth.
You're saying there's no racial inequality in the United States of America.
That's not what I'm saying. Don't put words in my mouth now, because it doesn't work that way. What I'm saying is his cause is an absolute fraud, because if he did care about race and black people being oppressed in this society, he wouldn't be talking about police officers, which is 0.00005% of black deaths in America. And he would be talking about, well, the 80% of black people that are being killed in Chicago every single weekend. The fact that in the 25 of the 100 largest cities in America right now today, the murder rate among African Americans by African Americans is skyrocketing. He would be going to those cities and saying, why are we killing one another in record numbers, instead of painting this false Black Lives narrative matter or Black Lives Matter narrative.
Why can't he do both?
The police officers are the cause of black strife in this country. So it's a fraud. He's a fraud. The Black Lives Matter organization is a fraud. And you know what? Jim Brown and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and some of the others who fought for civil rights in the 1960s had a pretty doggone good reason to. They were fighting for civil rights when civil rights did not exist for everybody in this country. But this is not 1960. This is 2016. It is an entirely different time. It's an entirely different era. And what Colin Kaepernick is trying to do with the help of the frauds, of the racial arsonists at Black Lives Matter, is simply reprehensible. And I don't think he deserves the attention he's getting.
So you believe that Jim Brown and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar are wrong?
I just told you what I believed, and I told you they were right in the 1960s. It is not 1960 anymore. And by the way, Jim Brown did not come out in support of Colin Kaepernick. All right, you're misstating that like every false narrative that the Black Lives Matter organization has put out, Rob. And I'll read it to you on the other side of this timeout for the Sports Center. Thanks so much for the phone call. But I'll read exactly what Jim Brown said to you. Because Jim Brown said what I said, that Colin Kaepernick has a right to go out there and express himself by way of free speech and expression. But he said that he is more concerned with the number of black people that are being killed in America's inner cities and inner city street violence and crime than he is with what Colin Kaepernick's cause is. So and I'll give you the exact quote on the other side. So let's not tell tales here. Let's be 100% honest. Colin Kaepernick's a fraud. The entire movement is a fraud. If they actually cared about people of color being oppressed in this country, they would get into the inner cities where people of color are truly being oppressed by the other people in the community. That's where the murders are happening off the charts. And the stats do not lie. More coming up. In fact, we're going to get away from this, and we're going to get back into college football with Bill Landis, who's going to talk to us about the Ohio State Buckeyes, not only the Week 2 win over Tulsa, but most importantly, the showdown in Norman with the Oklahoma Sooners coming up this Saturday in primetime. All of that coming up on the ticket.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Barrett out of the shotgun, option left side, Barrett keeping, gets to the 10, Barrett to the 5, Barrett to the pylon, and Barrett, touchdown! Ran it down the left side, got an excellent block from Curtis Samuel, and JT Barrett has given Ohio State a 26-3 lead on his second running touchdown of the year.
Onward we roll. It is 2:43. Jim Cushman, stop doing that. You're going to scare the living daylights out of me again. Hot are we right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Talking a little college football now. The showdown in Norman, everybody has known. The tune-up games for the Ohio State Buckeyes are gone. Running roughshod over Bowling Green and Tulsa. That's fine to get everything in sync and to get the new guys, the new starters, first-year guys ready to go with the veterans like JT Barrett and tremendous defensive starters that remain, although Tracy Sprinkle, of course, is a loss. But while the young guys try to step in, now it gets real. From the frying pan to the fire in Norman, Oklahoma, Buckeyes and Sooners joining us now to talk about it. Bill Landis from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. He covers those Ohio State Buckeyes, joining us now on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Outstanding. Great to have you on the program. It's good. It's been a while since we've talked Ohio State football with you. Before we get into the showdown in Norman, which is going to be just an outstanding football game in prime time, the best of what college football has to offer, what were your thoughts on what you saw on Saturday by the Buckeyes when obviously they started very sluggishly on the offensive side against a solid Tulsa Golden Hurricane team?
Yeah, I think you could come out of that with some mild concerns maybe about the offense, because, I mean, they look so good against Bowling Green, almost 800 yards of offense, 77 points. It was sluggish in that first half, and the first half, you can't blame the weather. It was pretty okay until the last few minutes of the first half, and then, oddly, the weather got worse and the offense got better. It didn't really make any sense. I don't know if it was conservative play calling or what. Maybe they didn't want to put some things on tape for Oklahoma to see, but it just seemed like they came out against Tulsa in that first half and thought, we're going to do some base things, keep it simple, and we should be able to move the ball. And then that wasn't the case. Tulsa's defense played really well in that first half and was kind of up to the task. And then they had that long rain delay, weather delay, and the offense came out and started opening things back up a little bit and then started moving the ball with ease and ended up putting up 40 points. So I don't really know how to take that first half against
Tulsa. Sorry about that, but we had a tech glitch there.
No worries. I'm just saying I don't know how to how to view that first half against Tulsa. I don't know if that was just poor play by the offense or just some kind of vanilla play calling, and then they realized maybe Tulsa was a little bit better than they thought they were, so had to open that up a little more.
We're talking to Bill Landis, Ohio State and Oklahoma coming up this Saturday, but looking back at the Tulsa game, and it's a good point. The way they played after the rain delay, though, obviously was you know, night and day. I mean, is that just coaching? Is that Urban Meyer sitting back in his office during the delay and looking at everything that he can on film or on stills and realizing what the differences were and getting these guys motivated, do you think? Is that the difference? Or maybe just the delay snap these guys out of their little funk and say, hey, you know what, we got to go out and play the way we know how to play?
I think the first thing you mentioned is certainly part of it, and Urban Meyer said that after the game. I think he and Ed Warner and Tim Beck, the three who were involved in the play calling, sort of got together and said, obviously, what we're doing is not working. We're not moving the ball against what's not a very good defense on paper, at least in Tulsa. So I think they just got together, saw the things that weren't working, decided to open the playbook up a little more. We saw some wildcat stuff. They were working the ball to the edge of the field, which is sort of their bread and butter, and weren't relying solely on kind of inside run plays, which weren't working. They went back to what worked really well against Bowling Green.
Bill, let's talk about quarterbacks coming up this weekend in Norman. Baker Mayfield is a very, very good player, a Heisman candidate in a lot of people's eyes. May or may not get there, but he is a very good player. Obviously, JT Barrett started the season like a house of fire, and he made a Heisman type of statement. Who's got the better signal caller going into this game on Saturday?
Oh, that's a good question.
That's why I asked you.
It depends on what you like, I guess. I'm actually writing a story about this for later in the week, about how Baker Mayfield is sort of the anti-JT Barrett, in the sense that Baker Mayfield kind of plays like a crazy person. He'll run in the backfield 15 yards if it means keeping a play alive and getting the ball downfield. And I don't know if I've ever seen JT Barrett turn his back on a play, let alone run backwards 15 yards. So if you like conservative play and then guy that's kind of going to get it done and move the ball forward and in the traditional manner, I guess JT Barrett's your guy. But if you like more exciting quarterback play and a guy who's high risk, high reward, which I think is a pretty good label for Baker Mayfield, then that's the guy you go with. I guess at this point I would say that Baker Mayfield's probably got a leg up because JT Barrett wasn't very good last year and Baker Mayfield was a Heisman candidate. I know JT was in 2014, but I think JT still, in my eyes at least, needs to work back a little bit from what he did last year because I thought he did not look very good. So if I had to pick one at this particular moment, I'd pick Mayfield. But JT Barrett certainly changed my mind on Saturday.
Yeah, and that's certainly fair, too, because JT obviously didn't even start the season as the starter last year when they had that whole Cardale-JT thing. And then, you know, based on what happened the year before in the playoffs when Cardale Jones won the championship, you know, behind center. So it's understandable. But JT, you know, he's the unquestioned guy now, and obviously he's got the ability to break out and do some spectacular things. Let's talk about defending Baker Mayfield, though. Raekwon McMillan talked about this. He said, just when you think you've got this guy on the ground, when you think you've held your coverage for four, five, 6 seconds, then he breaks out and creates another 4 or 5 seconds for his offense. He creates more time on plays and more time for receivers to get open, and it's just hard to play defense on one play for 10 or 12 seconds. It's a great line by Raekwon McMillan, and it's absolutely accurate. So what can Ohio State do to make sure that they get pressure on him for 4 or 5 or 6 seconds and not 7, 8, 9, or 10?
Well, I think the one thing they can't do is really when they're rushing the passer, they can't over pursue. And I think this defense has done that at times over the last 2 or 3 years. They have excellent pass rushers, and I think you get a little overzealous sometimes when you get to the backfield and you want to bring that guy down. But Baker Mayfield's a great athlete, and he can make you miss. So you don't want to run past him, because if you run past him, then you're in trouble, because Baker Mayfield's going to make a play. So I think they have to be smart in how they contain him. You can't just go right at him and try to knock him down. You want to hit the quarterback, but you have to do it in a smart manner. So I think they want to get their hands up. He's 5'11". He's a little quarterback, which is kind of crazy when you see how athletic he is. He's a really small guy.
Yeah.
So I think they got to try to get into his face, but they cannot get into a situation where they're just trying to run in and like rip Baker Mayfield's head off, because he kind of thrives on that. It's almost like he welcomes you to do that because he thinks he can make you miss. And when he does that, he starts making plays downfield with his legs and throwing the ball downfield.
Bill, what do you think? We're talking to Bill Landis, who covers the Ohio State Buckeyes for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Northeast Ohio Media Group, Cleveland.com. You can find him online. As a matter of fact, we just tweeted about him online at BillLandis25. I got to make sure you have an underscore in there somewhere, don't you, Bill?
No underscore, just the number 25 there. And there's three L's in the middle. That's weird.
Gotcha. Okay, thanks. Bill, what do you think that Urban Meyer watches and sees when he watches that Houston game for week number one, in which the Cougars upset the then third-ranked Sooners, and says, that's what we can do too. That's what we can exploit. There has to be a lesson there on what Houston did to beat Oklahoma by 10.
I think they're going to have to throw the ball. I watched a little bit of that Houston-Oklahoma game myself, and it seemed like Oklahoma had some questions in its secondary, particularly a cornerback. I don't know this for sure, but I think they've used multiple, I think 3 or 4 starting corners in the first two games they've played. And there was one guy on Houston, number 88, his last name's Dunbar, I don't know what his first name is. He was behind the secondary.
Stephen Dunbar, yeah.
Yeah, he was behind the secondary on every play. There were a lot of openings for Houston to stretch the field in the passing game. And obviously when that happens, then you can start running the ball a little more. So I think there's a lot of onus this week on JT Barrett and even more so maybe the outside receivers, to get some separation and to make some plays down the field to open things up for the rest of the offense. Because Oklahoma's defensive line is pretty good. They have good pass rushers. I think their linebackers are pretty good. So running the ball is not going to be easy. And it's made easier if Ohio State's able to get things going through the air.
Bill, what about the intangibles? Oklahoma season's on the line, quite literally. You know, you lose that opener to Houston, you can still make the playoffs with one loss. You run the table from here on out. You've got a great opportunity to impress, you know, the committee and get yourself into the Final Four. You lose a second time and you're done. Your season is over. You're at home against the Ohio State Buckeyes. I kind of feel like, not that Ohio State ever wants to lose, but Oklahoma's got the sense of urgency that the Buckeyes may not have at this moment.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Ohio State, too, and like you said, I don't think they're going in thinking it's okay if we lose, but Ohio State at least has been in the position to know that if you lose a game early, you can sort of win favor back with the playoff committee. And if they lost a close game on the road at Oklahoma and then ended up running the table, I don't think they'd really be penalized for that.
Agreed.
Oklahoma, on the other hand, we haven't seen a two-loss team in the playoff yet, and I don't think you're going to see it this year. Even if Oklahoma wins every Big 12 game, they're going to have two losses against arguably the two best teams are going to play this year. And if you're not beating the best teams on your schedule, or at least splitting the two games with the best teams on your schedule, then you're not getting into the playoff. So there's a lot on the line for Oklahoma, probably a little bit more so than Ohio State, but it's important for Ohio State too, because Ohio State wants to show that it's a playoff contender despite losing all the starters they lost. They have a bunch of new guys. They didn't play great teams in the first 2 weeks, but looked good, and they have to kind of back that up this week.
Hey, Bill, before I ask you to pick this game, since we're talking about Oklahoma, I can go ahead and throw the word state after it and just ask your opinion about what happened with Central Michigan, because we're here in Toledo, we're in MAC country, you know, and Central Michigan beating Oklahoma State in that ridiculous finish. Come to find out, it shouldn't have happened. The Big 12 and the MAC both announced that the officiating and instant replay crews who worked that game have been suspended for two games. It never should have happened. Do you think there's ever a point where the schools and the conferences and everybody can get together and say, yeah, that game finished at 0-0-0. That last play never happened. Can you ever wipe that out?
I don't know. Maybe in that situation, a non-conference game, I mean, Central Michigan is obviously not going to the playoff. Oklahoma State probably doesn't have those aspirations, although they were a ranked team. Maybe, I mean, that's, I don't know what you do. You suspend the referees, but Oklahoma State still lost a game that they should not have lost. That game shouldn't have counted. So yeah, I mean, if there is a next step, I guess that's it, but I don't know if you'll ever get a team. I don't know if Central Michigan is going to come to the table and say, oh yeah, we'll get rid of that loss or no problem.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
they're
going to
want that win in every scenario.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, we've embraced instant replay at virtually every level in which games are televised, and we have all of these angles to make sure we get every call right. So if we have instant replay, and we now know that that call was wrong and they should not have been allowed to run another play, I feel like there's got to be, all right, let's get it right and say that last play did not happen. As exciting as it was done when it should not have been done. We now know that. So the final score is Oklahoma State 27 and Central Michigan, what was it, 23 at that point? Or 24?
Right.
27-24. I mean, that's just the way that it should be. I feel like that's the way that it ought to be.
Yeah, especially in that scenario, because it wasn't, I guess you just end it wherever the game was supposed to end. So Oklahoma State was winning, then Oklahoma State wins. The game was tied. I mean, you're not going to bring those two teams back together and play an overtime period if someone wins, so you just end it in the tie and chalk it up to human error. I mean, you're subject to that. If you're going to have humans refereeing games and they don't know the rule book, then you have to kind of deal with the consequences when they make a colossal mistake like that.
And Jim Quislin here, thanks, Bill, for bringing up the rule book, because, Bob, you mentioned it's replay. This whole thing with Oklahoma State and Central Michigan, you don't even need replay for it. It's in the rule books that the play shouldn't have even been run in the first place.
Yeah, and I bring up replay because they suspended the replay crew, too. Because obviously everybody dropped the ball here. I just bring it up because we have embraced, technology to use whatever we have to do to make sure that every call is right. So nobody is robbed of a game that they shouldn't be based on a bad call. That's why we do this. And the rule book is the rule book, as you just pointed out, Bill, and Jim, as you just, confirmed. And that's the way it ought to be. Let's get it right so that somebody who didn't lose a game for real doesn't have that L in their column right now. And they're now, they went from being 22nd ranked to out of the rankings, and they shouldn't be. It's just, I don't know. I just kind of want to get it right. We're either gonna use technology and use, every tool at our disposal to get calls right so that the correct teams win and the teams that deserve to lose, or we're not. And I feel like it's not being done here. And no diss to Central Michigan. I mean, what a fantastic finish. What an amazing play drawn up that way. Great thing, but just a bad result, I think, at the end for Oklahoma State. All right, Bill Landis, last thing for you then is to pick this game in Norman, knowing that Oklahoma's got that sense of urgency that we talked about that maybe Ohio State doesn't, but knowing that Ohio State just flat out might be better, who wins in Norman Saturday night?
Yeah, you're not going to like my answer very much, but I don't know. Before the season started, I said that Ohio State was going to lose this game. I'm probably still leaning that way, but I in my head, I'm like envisioning a shootout. Mm-hmm. I know Ohio State's defenses look very good, but I was pretty impressed with Oklahoma, and there's two running backs and Baker Mayfield, obviously. I could envision a scenario where both these teams are in the 40s, and it's an exciting game, but I haven't made my official pick yet, but I think I'm still probably leaning toward Oklahoma, which is where I was before the season started.
All right. I think that's fair. We talk about it a lot here when we pick games at the high school level and everything else. If you have teams that are relatively close in talent and ability, and there really isn't one clear defining factor as to why a visiting team should win, then you kind of go with the home team. And that's kind of how I feel about it here. It ought to really be, Oklahoma that gets a slight edge here just simply because they are in Norman, and then we'll let the chips fall where they may. Hey, Bill, great analysis. I really appreciate it and enjoyed the conversation. Hopefully we can talk again soon.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Bill. Bill Landis joining us right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket from Cleveland. He is a Buckeye writer out of the Cleveland area for Cleveland.com. All right, good stuff on the Buckeyes front. Now we're going to shift gears after the top of the hour to the Wolverines front. We're going to talk with Drew Hallett of MazeandBrew.com. Wolverines look very, very good. They are just one spot behind the Buckeyes in the rankings after a couple of weeks at number four. And what perfect segue, what a better segue could we have to go into the Buckeye store and more, the college and pro superstore than Buckeye and Michigan conversation. That's right. Do you know that there are hundreds of new Nike products in stock for Ohio State and Michigan at the Buckeye store and more? And also, right now, you can get 10% store-wide savings. The early season sale is underway. You can even get 50 to 75% on select items, with doorbuster items available every day as well. Just look for Big Brutus on the Roof when you're in Sylvania on Monroe, Starlight Plaza, right in front of Prometica between Ralphie's and Dave's. The inflatable Brutus is available for pickup, by the way, or delivery if you want to put one on your front yard or on your porch for your next Buckeye game party. And don't forget, if you don't root for the Bucks or the Wolverines, maybe you're an Irish or a Spartans or a Rockets or a Falcons or a Tigers fan. That's right, baseball too. You have fan zones inside at the Buckeye store and more. Go find them. Hundreds of new products arriving daily. Starlight Plaza, 5700 Monroe in Sylvania, the Buckeye store and more, the College and Pros Superstore.
McCann setting up and in, 2-2. Swing and a miss. He got him on strikes.
Oh, man, another outstanding pitch.
11 strikeout for Daniel Norris, and every single strikeout on a swinging third strike. The 1-2. Swing the line drive down the left field line, hooking toward the corner. That is a fair ball. Rounding second, heading to third is Romine. Clark waving him around third. Relay to the plate from the outfield. Slide. Save. Tigers tie it up. The 3-2. Fly ball, right center field, hit it hard, got a chance, score!
Wow.
Miguel Cabrera, number 32, and the Tigers take a 4-2 lead in the eighth. First pitch, swinging a soft tapper to short, charging Iglesias, has to hurry, Fields throws, got him at first, Tigers win.
Well, I mean, he's not going to start during the regular season, so we know that. And I think we probably already knew that. Getting the news that we did is probably pretty damn good. It's musculature as opposed to something with a ligament or, you know, the repair that was already in there. So they'll give him the PRP injection to try to speed up the recovery, let him rest for a period of days, then start to ramp him back up. If we're fortunate enough to keep playing and we ramp him back up, good. You know, there's no reason to even speculate. Like I said, the one thing we want to do is get him healthy, make sure he knows he's healthy, because that's important. And then if it fits somewhere, good. But the biggest thing is to get him healthy. I don't think they need to try to do more than they can. Every time they start, it's a big night. Every time somebody does well, it helps everybody. But it's always a case. Guys can't be something they're not. You know, you start trying to pitch for you and somebody else, that makes it harder. They just need to do their thing and we'll be okay.
Hey, somebody has run out on the field. Some goofball in a hat and a red shirt. Now he takes off the shirt. He's running down the middle by the 50. He's at the 30. He's bare-chested and banging his chest. Now he runs the opposite way. He runs at the 50. He runs at the 40. The guy is drunk, but there he goes. The 20. They're chasing him. They're not going to get him. Waving his arms, bare-chested. Somebody stop
that
man.
Look out. Here comes the blue coat.
Oh, they got him.
Here comes
coming
the blue
from
coat.
The left. Oh, and they tackle him at the 40-yard line.
That was the most exciting thing to happen tonight.
I tell you what, that was a great call on your part.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It's more than a great call. That was an epic call on the part of Kevin Harlan. He's in a red shirt. Now he takes the shirt off.
He's drunk, and they're not going to get him.
He's bare-chested. He's pounding his chest. What a great, great call. What a fun time. Last night, the only fun that was had there in Levi Stadium in San Francisco, because the game was a boring game. The 49ers hammered the Los Angeles Rams, which lets you know how bad the Los Angeles Rams really are, because the 49ers are awful in their own right. So we got that going for us, which is nice. All right, we continue at 4:10 right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. Back to college football. Great stuff from Bill Landis, by the way, who covers the Buckeyes for Cleveland.com. Now we turn our attention to that team up north, just up in there in Ann Arbor. And, of course, we're talking about Jim Harbaugh's Wolverines. Drew Hallett joining us now from MazeandBrew.com, an SB Nation website, right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. Hey, Drew, how are you?
Doing well, Bob. How about you?
Outstanding. Jim Cushland is here as well. We appreciate the opportunity to talk Michigan football with you. Let's talk a little bit about UCF. Kind of an interesting thing with Scott Frost coming back up into Ann Arbor. Not exactly everybody's favorite ex-Nebraska quarterback after the way things went down in 1997 as he pled with voters to give Coach Tom Osborne a going-away present, co-national championship. A little sweet beatdown of UCF on Saturday as a result.
Yes, I think it was definitely a very nice victory for Michigan fans. I know that's something that they wanted to, they wanted to get that victory over Scott Frost for, let's say it's been 19 years now. So, obviously it didn't come in 1997. They would have liked the two teams to face off to see who was the national champion, but to have Scott Frost come to Ann Arbor and then Michigan able to beat, UCF like they did, I'm sure was very rewarding for those Michigan fans. And I think part of it, too, was the fact that, at the time and even since then, Scott Frost has been very vocal about, he believes his Huskers were better than the Wolverines. And, as the quarterback of that team, it's very understandable. You would expect him to believe that his team was the best, but to continue to bring it up here and there, even years later, I knew it was Michigan fans were happy to be able to lay that beat down on his team on Saturday.
I knew it was 1997, obviously, but I never really put it in those terms that you just did, that it's 19 years ago. You just freaked me out, man. That's been a long time. It's almost two decades since that national championship for Michigan. Drew, I don't know how old you are, but did you watch that game, or have you watched it since then? And when I say that game, I'm talking about the Rose Bowl in which Michigan beat Washington State and the man who would go on to be one of the biggest busts in the history of the National Football League draft, Ryan Leaf. And then Nebraska, of course. Did you watch those bowl games, or did you watch that season? And who do you think would have won a hypothetical matchup between Michigan and Nebraska?
I didn't watch those games. I was 8 years old at the time when those games were being played, and I wasn't a Michigan, I didn't follow Michigan football at the time, so I didn't watch those games.
Okay.
I have gone back since then on YouTube. You can find, the clips and the highlights and even the full game for,
sure.
Michigan and Washington State and the Rose Bowl, so I've gone back and watched those. But I never went back and watched, Nebraska at that time or watched, what Nebraska did. That night when they put the whipping on them. I'm trying to remember who they played. I think it was Tennessee because it was against Peyton Manning.
Yes, correct.
So I never actually saw that Nebraska team play. So I don't think I can give an actual opinion, or at least, a valid one or a qualified one, I should say, in terms of who I think was the better team. But it definitely would have been interesting to see that, that Michigan defense, maybe one of the greatest Michigan defenses of all time, go against that offense and Scott Frost and to see what would have happened. I'm sure all wish it could have happened.
That was an all-time great defense. That defense that Michigan put out there that year, and as great as Nebraska was, and Scott Frost was obviously a huge part of that, I really don't think they would have had any more luck cracking that defense than anybody else did that year. That was a really all-time great defense in college football. I would have loved to have seen that, and I did watch those games. I'm a little bit older than you, so I did watch those games in the bowl season, and, of course, just the entire season. And, I really felt like Lloyd Carr was correct when he told his team after the Rose Bowl, "You just won the national championship." Not half of it, but you just won the national championship. So, anyway, that's a little blast in the past because you reminded me of 19 years ago. Let's get more current now, and let's talk about the way the Wolverines have looked through 2 weeks. Obviously, not very strong competition, and putting up 63 and 58 points would indicate that. What is your impression of this team with Wilton Spate now as its new quarterback? Obviously, there is All-American talent at a number of positions. They seem to be, kind of clicking right now, again, against some weaker competition as they try to put it all together. What's your assessment?
The first 2 weeks have gone pretty much as well as they could go for Michigan thus far. They looked very good in both games. Not only did they blow out both Hawaii and UCF, there was never really any drama in those games. They were up 35-0, I believe, pretty quickly, or 28-0 very quickly on Hawaii, and then they were up 31-0 pretty quickly on UCF in about the first 20 minutes of the game. So, they pulled away pretty quickly, and it was never close. The biggest questions for me going into this season were, Michigan's offensive line, then obviously Wilton Spate. So far, Wilton Spate has looked, very good as Jake Rudock's successor. Last season, it took Rudock maybe two-thirds of the season to really start feeling comfortable in Jim Harbaugh's offense, and that was somewhat understandable because, Rudick had just come in June, July, August, really only had fall practices before he was the starter in Michigan's offense. Whereas, you know, Spate has come in and he's had, you know, 18 months under Harbaugh to really learn the system, you know, to develop. And you can see right off the bat, again, you know, it hasn't been the best competition. But if you look at, you know, this past week with Rude, with Spate against UCF, the Knights really, their game plan was to load the box and force Wilton Spate to beat them over the top. And they, you know, they brought pressure, they brought blitzes, and despite them coming, you know, bringing waves of defenders in his face, he stood tall in the pocket and, you know, threw some very, very nice balls into some tight windows in the first half and ended up, you know, completing, you know, over 68% of his passes for 312 yards, four touchdowns, no interceptions. So, you know, with Spate looking like he did and, you know, looking like a very competent quarterback, you know, that's a good sign for Michigan going forward. And then defensively, they looked as good as, you know, they were expected to. You know, they looked very stingy up front, even with Jordan Lewis out as an All-American cornerback. You know, the corners still look very good in the secondary. You know, there was obviously a couple issues here and there in the UCF game, which maybe we can discuss in a sec. But just as an overall impression, it's gone about as well as it can go, and they're looking strong so far.
Yeah, and that is about all we can ask of them and really analyze about them right now. Drew Hallett is doing the analysis for us. He is with MaizeAndBrew.com, an SB Nation website covering the Michigan Wolverines. Bob France with you. Jim Cushlin is here as well. Jim, go ahead, bud.
And thinking of Wilton Spate and what he's been able to do so far in two games, obviously, you know, he being a sophomore taking over for Rudock, it's hard to truly, I think, fully gauge just because of the quality, quote-unquote, of the opponents in Hawaii and Central Florida. But he's got a great trio of guys, all seniors, that he could throw the ball to. Jake Butt at tight end and Darbo and Chesson as the wideouts. How important is it for him getting his, you know, first full-time snaps these last two games and then obviously going forward with Colorado and the Big Ten schedule after that? How important is it, though, for Spate to have that senior leadership in the guys he's throwing to?
Oh, it's very key. You know, one of the things you look at when you have receivers, like that, you know, especially, you know, Jake Butt, you know, J.U. Chesson and, Amara Darbo, is that they do a very good job of getting separation. They're, you know, they're very talented. And so they make it a lot easier for Spate. So, you know, there was, like I said, there were situations where, you know, he did throw balls into tight windows, but there's also times when, you know, those receivers are able to get, you know, a lot of separation from the defenders and to make the throws a lot easier for him. And knowing that you have guys that can do that and have that confidence in your receivers to make those kind of plays, it makes it a lot easier on Wilton Spate. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And it's actually somewhat similar to when Chad Henne was a freshman throwing for Michigan back in, I believe it was 2004, you know, when he had Braylon Edwards and, you know, Jason Avant and those kind of experienced playmakers there to kind of help him ease into the role as a, you know, an inexperienced young starter. And though Wilton Spate is not a true freshman or a freshman, he's a redshirt sophomore. You know, you kind of see those similarities into a guy coming into his own and having those experienced playmakers on the outside making it a lot easier for him.
We're talking to Drew Hallett about the Michigan Wolverines, who got one first-place vote in the AP Top 25 rankings this week. They did not get any in the coaches' poll right now. They sit fourth in the AP, and they sit fifth in the coaches' poll in both places. They are one spot behind Ohio State. All right, let's talk about the challenge now of Colorado, not the Colorado of old, although they want the Wolverines to believe that they are. Colorado is going to wear their 1994 throwback uniforms against Michigan this week in an attempt maybe to revive the ghost of the Hail Mary, the Cordell Stewart to Michael Westbrook game that was just a dagger in the heart of Michigan fans everywhere. So they're not that same Colorado caliber program. They want Michigan to think that they are. What kind of a challenge do they pose, Drew?
I'm very intrigued to see what happens this weekend. You know, Colorado has really struggled the past couple of years. You know, last season they went 4-9. The year before that, I believe they just had, you know, two or three wins. You know, they've had a really hard time, you know, getting their, you know, getting their placing and their, you know, getting their footing right in the Pac-12. However, they have looked like they've improved a decent amount, or at least a pretty good amount so far this season. Going into that home opener against Colorado State, mind you, it's only Colorado State, but they were maybe a 7-point favorite. You know, it wasn't, you know, it was supposed to be somewhat close. And yet they went out and, you know, just ran right all over the Rams and, you know, blew them out. I believe it was 44-7. Then they took care of Idaho State last weekend, 56-7. However, Idaho State is maybe one of the worst teams in FCS. So that doesn't really say too much. However, you know, Colorado will present a couple different challenges. You know, one of the things that Michigan's defense has somewhat struggled with, especially at the end of last season, was, you know, going against teams that were up-tempo, spread offenses, really like to, you know, try to catch Michigan off guard and out of position. And, you know, you saw that a little bit here and there against UCF this past weekend, you know, a couple runs that, you know, not necessarily quarterback scrambles, but two runs that, you know, really went for big gains to the bus by Michigan defense. Well, they're going against Colorado this weekend, who's an up-tempo team. I believe they're third in adjusted pace so far this season. They really like to get it going. They have a dual-threat quarterback in Sefo Lufau, who can, you know, provide some challenges. So I think it's going to be a little bit of a test, but ultimately Michigan's still a 20-point favorite in this game. And because Colorado may, you know, run the ball decently well and they have that tempo, they don't break a lot of big plays. You know, they try to move the ball efficiently, methodically. And Michigan's defense up front especially is very good at shutting that down. You know, they're very, very good at keeping games, you know, to, you know, 2 yards or less or fewer. And so I think Colorado's going to have a difficult time, especially trying to move the ball against this Michigan defense. And I think Michigan will end up winning comfortably, but it will be interesting to see how they respond to the Buffaloes and the challenge they provide this weekend.
I'm curious, Drew, as to what kind of an offensive attack they're gonna have against Colorado. Just looking at the opener against Hawaii, they ran the ball for 300 yards, 7.8 a pop. Ton of guys got carries, obviously, in the route. Last week it was also a route, but they didn't run the ball very well at all. 41 carries, 119 yards, 2.9 yards a carry. So, you know, night and day in terms of, you know, the way they approached it, or at least certainly the way they carried it out. Actually, the way they approached it, I can't say that. 39 rushes in one and 41 in the other, but obviously very different results. So do you expect them to try to reestablish the run and maybe take some of that big play capability and quick strike stuff that you're talking about that Colorado might like to use, you know, away from them by just keeping the ball away from them?
I think Michigan, well, for the last two games against Hawaii and UCF, the reason why we saw such differences in Michigan's offensive tendencies and strategies was because of the way the defense was played. You know, Michigan was able to run through Hawaii very easily, whereas UCF, you know, their defensive game plan was to load the box. I mean, they were putting 8, 9, 10 defenders in the box and pretty much, you know, daring Michigan, you know, telling them, we're not going to let you run. If you're going to beat us, you're going to have to throw the ball. And Michigan did by going over the top and, you know, hitting Jake Budd and Amar Darboh and Jehu Chesson. And that's how they were, you know, they started, you know, running a lot of play action to try to counter, you know, what UCF was doing. It'll be interesting to see what Colorado does this weekend. I think Michigan's going to want to, again, to try to reestablish the run. I think that's what they generally would like to do. And a defense will try to, you know, stuff the run. Then they're going to say, fine, we're going to go to the pass. But the other reason why I think Michigan will try to establish the run is because Colorado is their front defensive. They run a 3-4, and their defensive front is not that big in terms of size. And Michigan's offensive line should be able to, you know, move those guys around at the line of scrimmage and create gaps and holes for Devion Smith and Chris Evans to run through. And also because I believe Colorado actually has a pretty good secondary. They have a cornerback, and I got to look up his name again, but in Chidobo Awuzie. He was a very, very talented corner, and, you know, he's a very, very much a playmaker. He was a guy last year who had 12 tackles for loss, had 9 passes defense. He makes plays, whether it's behind the line of scrimmage or when the ball is being thrown at him. I think that Michigan's going to want to maybe try to avoid him, even with, you know, Darboh and Chesson. And I think they're going to want to try to establish the run, keep the ball out of Colorado's hands, especially since Colorado's going to try to, you know, get the pace moving. I think that Michigan's going to want to control the tempo, control the clock, and move the ball that way.
All right, Drew, really good analysis. We appreciate it. Last thing before you go, I mentioned those rankings before the last question. Are they about right? And do you even buy into any of these rankings at this early stage? Jim and I have both talked about this many, many times on this program, about how we don't think the first ranking from the AP or the coaches should come out until the first Monday of October. Let everybody play in September 3 or 4 times, however, whatever your schedule looks like, and then maybe even the first Saturday of October. So you got 3, 4, or 5 games under your belt. Then we'll put the first ranking out there and make it real. So we don't have to take teams that were 3 and put them down at 20 because they lost, or teams that weren't even in the top 25. Suddenly they're 10th best in the country because it's such a guessing game going into a season. What are your thoughts on the ranking system and then where the Wolverines are right now in that system?
I understand the sentiment for wanting to wait a couple of weeks before the rankings come out and try to get a better idea of what, you know, how to, you know, to evaluate these teams based on current information. But I actually think the preseasons are not as bad as a lot of people make them out to be. When you look at it from like an individual team perspective, you're obviously, there's going to be teams that were overrated and they were not nearly as good as expected. There's going to be teams outside the top 25 that, you know, surprise and end up being very good. That's going to happen in any ranking system. It doesn't really matter. But I actually, you know, there's been evidence to show that, you know, the preseason rankings are actually very, very accurate. You know, we have to give, you know, the media and, you know, the coaches, you know, the people credit ahead of time. we actually do a pretty good job of evaluating these teams before they even take the field based on, you know, returning talent and production and, you know, the upcoming schedules. And we actually have a pretty good idea of what these teams are going to do for the most part. And I think that I'm okay with the preseason rankings. And I actually think that after the first couple of weeks, as voters, the AP, you know, or even the coaches are so reactive to individual game results that I think it's almost an overreaction sometimes. Like, for example, Wisconsin going from unranked to number 10 after their win against LSU and LSU dropping from 3 to 22. If you think Wisconsin's the 10th best team after that, then that means that you think that LSU's probably a pretty good team. Then why would LSU drop from 3 to 22? So I just think that the issue is that after that first week, we start becoming very reactive to individual results, and that's where things start getting kind of a little crazy. But as, you know, the weeks go on and we get the weeks, you know, 4, 5, 6, that's when the rankings will really start to sort themselves out, and we'll have a pretty good idea, start having a good idea of who these, you know, what the good teams are. Go ahead.
No, I was just reintroducing you to let Jim Kushlin ask his final question, but that's a great point that you make, and it's well-reasoned. I still don't like them, but you make some very good, valid points as far as the early season rankings. I just think it's, you know, especially when you have such turnover, graduation losses, et cetera, transfers, teams are not, when they start one season, what they were when they ended another season, and I think there's just, it's just silly to, and you don't have a preseason to look at them the way you do in the NFL, not that those really even mean anything either. But at least, you know, you would have some kind of sense of what they look like against foreign competition. I'm not a fan of them. But Jim Cushman's got one more question. Go ahead, Jimmy.
And I have to end this on a light note, guys. I really do, because as we were talking, I accidentally just discovered this. We all remember last week the brief hilarity, because with everything with this team, you know, Jim Harbaugh, he's making me laugh. I love this guy just on the laugh principle. And remember,
you're not going to do this story.
Yes,
you're not
going to
bring this up.
Yes, I am. Did either of you guys see Colorado's fake depth chart that features guys like Eric Cartman at left tackle, the Blues Brothers as the wide receivers, Drebin, Alex Foley as corners, as Colorado's trying to mess a little bit with Michigan? Because we remember last week with the whole not going to release tape to Hawaii thing and all that silliness. My only question is, speculate, guys, for me, what's Jim Harbaugh's hilarious response to this going to be?
I mean, I don't even know if Jim Harbaugh is going to really care that much, to be honest. I mean, he seems to be, I mean, he'll, you know, have his, you know, he'll drop some, you know, funny quotes here and there, and he'll have his antics here and there, but, you know, there's, I'm sure someone will, it'll be brought up to him, and he'll maybe chuckle or something, but ultimately, I think he's going to be pretty focused on football at this point. He's not going to care too much either way. But I did find the fake depth chart pretty entertaining. There were some pretty good names on there. There's no doubt about that. And it's nice to see that Colorado's having some fun with it. But, you know, sometimes, you know, maybe Jim Harbaugh takes it the other way. Maybe he tries to use this as, oh, they're not taking it seriously, or they're trying to poke the bear, maybe, and maybe he tries to turn this into something else. I don't know, but ultimately, I think Colorado is just trying to have some fun with it, and it shouldn't be taken too seriously.
Yeah, I do too. I think it's fun. I think Harbaugh would think it's fun. I don't think he's going to do much with it at all. And they are trying to poke the bear, not with that, but with the throwback uniforms, like I said, to 1994 with the Cordell Stewart to White Michael Westbrook dagger in the hearts of Michigan fans all throughout Michigan Stadium and the world. That was an amazing, amazing play. One of the great, and by great, I mean, you know, amazing, but not great for Michigan fans, Hail Marys in college history. No, Jim, the reason I said no, you're not going to do that story is I thought you were going to ask him. See, here's why Jim Harbaugh doesn't have time to be dealing
with it. I already know what story you're going to mention, too.
Yeah.
I already know which one it's going to be.
Yeah, that's the one I thought you were going with, Jim. Jim Harbaugh, instead of dealing with fake depth charts, has to dodge booger accusations. Literally, booger accusations. If those who don't know this story care, and you really shouldn't, but he cared enough, did Harbaugh, to answer the question on his radio show last night in Ann Arbor, in which Jim Brandstetter asked him to clarify the social media, you know, viral images of him reportedly rubbing the inside of his nose, and then, well, here's the quote from Jim Harbaugh: "I have never eaten a booger in my entire life. That might have looked like what was happening, but I think if you rub your nose and then you bite your fingernail, that's not eating a booger. There was no booger eating. Let me clear the air. For clarity here, for the record, I have never eaten a booger in my entire life. Period. End quote." I wouldn't have brought it up, Drew. I wouldn't have made you address this, but now that Jim put it in my mind by saying, I'll give you a light story here to end the conversation. Have you ever heard anything in your life as absurd as that story?
I'm sure if I, you know, really thought about it for a little bit, I'm sure I can find something that's pretty absurd. But the funny thing is, with Jim Harbaugh, since he's arrived at Ann Arbor, there's been so many different headlines and stories, whether it's, you know, him taking his shirt off to play Peru ball during the satellite camps, or, you know, him, you know, doing the sleeping over at the recruit house as a recruiting tactic, you know, to, right. you know, on the overnights and things like that. There's been so many different headlines here and there that at this point you think that, you know, there's nothing that's really going
to
surprise
you. Paintball contests against little kids.
Yeah, it gets to a point where you just kind of think, oh, there's nothing that's really going to surprise you. But no, I never really thought we were going to have a booger accusation type or story. No, I didn't see that one coming. But yeah, despite everything else that's happened, I definitely didn't see that one coming.
And I wish we had not seen that coming. I wish it had not happened. And I had forgotten all about it. I was not even going to bring it up, and then Jim brought it to my mind. So my apologies, Drew. Great analysis. Any idea of a score? Can you predict a score for us with the Wolverines and the Buffaloes?
I'm still kind of putting together my picks for the weekend. I haven't really formulated my prediction yet, but you know, the spread's about 20 right now, and I think that's probably going to be about right. I do think Colorado, like I said, you know, they do provide that up-tempo offense, and they can provide a little bit of challenges here and there. But ultimately, Colorado has not really proven themselves. You know, they've struggled in the recent years. Michigan has, you know, proved it last year. You know, they look very strong again this year. They're at home. I mean, about a 21 to 24 point victory sounds about right. So if I had to pick something, I guess I would say let's go 34 to 10.
All right. Sounds like a plan. Drew, hey, thanks for the analysis. We really appreciate it. And thanks for having some fun with us, too. We look forward to talking to you again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. There you go. Drew Hallett, MasonBrew.com, a part of SB Nation Online. That Harbaugh story, I saw the headline yesterday, and the headline was, quote, Jim Harbaugh, I have never eaten a booger in my entire life. And I said, what? Is this an Onion story? Is this some sort of parody or spoof story? I was like, what is this? And then I read it, and come to find out that during the Central Florida game on Saturday, cameras panned to Harbaugh, who appeared, and I'm reading directly from MLive.com. Our good friend Nick Baumgartner wrote this, Jim. Harbaugh appeared to be picking his nose, and then appeared to follow that up with the second thing most children are taught not to do at an early age. Speaking on his radio show Monday in Ann Arbor, Harbaugh brought this up with co-host. And that's right, Harbaugh brought it up.
That's right.
Harbaugh wanted everybody to know, as a point of clarification, that it did not happen. It reminds me of the Seinfeld episode where he was at the light and his model girlfriend was in the car next to him and he didn't realize, and he was scratching the outside of his nose, but he was, you know, on the opposite side of where she was, so it looked like his finger was knuckle deep. And he had to spend the rest of the episode anyway, trying to convince her that it did not happen. That was Jim Harbaugh in this situation. He went on his radio show to tell everybody listening, I've never done that in my entire life. That's your cue, Cush.
That is just too funny. But no, I really wasn't going to. I'm looking for a Michigan thing, so I'm like, fake depth chart. Oh, is Colorado trying to poke the bear? And I just started reading the names. I'm like, this is hysterical. You know, good for them for having fun with it. But I was not going to bring up the booger story.
Did you hear about it before?
Yes.
That?
Yeah, I did.
I completely had forgotten about it, which I was happy, by the way. I was very happy about that. I was thinking, yes, that's great. It escaped my mind's eye and my memory, which is exactly what I wanted it to do. And then bang, you go, I got to end this on a light note here. Here's a story. And I thought, oh no, you reminded me of something I did not want to be reminded of, even if you didn't, bring that one up.
So. Well, that was not my intention on that. My intention on that was just because I found this literally during the segment that Colorado releases a fake depth chart.
There's no
to get
bear poking there because it's just, you know, I mean, they didn't insult him. They just said Michigan's not releasing a depth chart, so we'll make up our own.
Right, right. It's exactly. But these little stories, this is why I love Jim Harbaugh at Michigan. There's never going to be a dull moment, and I love that.
If you want to get the Harbaugh booger story out of your mind's eye, maybe this will do it. Oh, it didn't fire. I wanted to give you the last play of that game in 1994. Hold on. Let me see if I can make this fight. Okay, here we go. Hold on.
One more. It's 6 seconds. I think he just went over and says, just throw it up. Three wide outs at the top of the picture. Stewart with time. Let's it go.
He's got three people down there. The ball's up in the air. Caught. Touchdown. Caught by Westbrook for a touchdown. Incredible.
They call it the Miracle in Michigan, Cordell Stewart. On that tremendous Colorado. This gym was number four. Ooh. A little karma, perhaps. I don't know what's going on here. This game was number seven Colorado against number four Michigan in Ann Arbor, 1994. Cordell Stewart, Rashawn Salaam, Michael Westbrook, a big three, if you will, that was just tremendous at Colorado. Michigan was number four at the time. Guess what Michigan is ranked right now? They are number four in the AP poll as Colorado pulls out the 1994 throwback jerseys for this game at Michigan, trying to remind them of that epic collapse at the Colorado Buffalo Hands. So that is a really, really interesting little sidebar there. I wanted to get the Jim Harbaugh Booger story out of your mind. How about the story of Cordell Stewart? How about that image, dropping back further, and then letting fly? He threw that ball about 70 yards in the air right to the goal line and into the end zone for Michael Westbrook, who caught it off the bounce and gave Colorado that huge win. Cost Michigan really an opportunity at the national championship that year. Back, of course, there was no BCS then or no college football playoff. But
of course, they messed up Ohio State later on in the year.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, I bet you're wishing you had the, after having that image in your head, I bet you wish you had the Harbaugh image in your head now. How about putting an image of racks and racks and racks of Ohio State merchandise? Put that image in your head, because that's what you're going to find at the Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro Superstore in Sylvania. Hundreds of new Nike products in stock right now at the Buckeye Store and More for Ohio State and for your Michigan Wolverines. Matter of fact, you can get 10% store-wide savings on all of that merchandise. In fact, 10% savings on everything, including all of the other fan zones, including the Fighting Irish, the Spartans, the Rockets, the Falcons, and baseball's Detroit Tigers. If you want 50 to 75% off select items, just get in there early for the doorbuster sales. The Buckeye Store and More is in Sylvania, 5700 Monroe, right between Ralphie's and Dave's in front of Prometica and Starlight Plaza. If you can't find it, look for Big Brutus on the roof. You can't miss him. He's there, and he's available, by the way, for order, for pickup or delivery, so you can have him at your next Buckeye party. So that's the Buckeye Store and More in Starlight Plaza in Sylvania, 5700 Monroe Street, Starlight Plaza, the Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro Superstore.
Now, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on are we on the extravaganza. Thanks so much to our guests. We had some really good conversation with Drew Hallett of MaizeandBrew.com, a Michigan site. Of course, we had Bill Landis on before that of the Buckeye, or covering the Buckeyes, I should say, for the Northeast Ohio Media Group. And it's going to be a very interesting weekend in college football, no question about that, especially in Norman, Oklahoma. Christian, I didn't get your pick. JT Barrett or Baker Mayfield first on the quarterback. And you know what? Let's try to open it up here before we're done.
Sure.
We have Mr. Miller waiting in the wings. He's got drive time coming your way at 5 o'clock. But I got time to squeeze a couple of calls in now if you dial now at 866-240-1065. Baker Mayfield, a Heisman candidate last year. JT Barrett, a Heisman candidate the year before, because last year, you know, remember he got injured the year before. He probably would have been on the podium as a finalist.
I think so.
The year before, last year, he was, you know, he didn't play as well, and he shared time with Cordell Stewart from the Colorado story to Cardale Jones. Anyway, but JT Barrett expected, now maybe to make another run at it this year. Who would you choose right now, Mayfield or Barrett, and then who wins on Saturday? We want you at 866, by the way, 240-1065. Buckeye fans, give us your thoughts on that.
Well, I'm going to go JT Barrett, and it's not just because I get to see him more, and I love what he's been able to do. I'm seeing a maturity and growth in him in these couple games, obviously this year and whatnot, and it's a very interesting process that he's gone through with the Buckeyes to be able to. This is no knock on Baker Mayfield. You know, he's a solid quarterback. But I'm going to say that his ability to run the football which A.T. Barrett is the capper for me. I'm just digging up, for example, Baker Mayfield says, got outstanding passing numbers, as one would know, but he's not really a runner. 13 carries,
yeah,
minus
he,
one
no,
on the year.
He's not a runner in that regard, but he's a runner in what he does behind the,
yes.
the line of scrimmage.
Yes.
You know, the scrambling and the ability to keep plays alive in the pocket. That's what Raekwon McMillan was talking about. You know, when he said, you know, this guy makes us cover. It's already tough enough to cover, you know, 6 or 7 seconds, you know, in the secondary against great receivers.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible when you have to do it for 10 or 11 seconds, and that is what Mayfield Baker makes you do.
Yeah, and I would think the
Mayfield. I just called him Mayfield Baker.
Yeah, I didn't even catch that.
Two last names here, and we're messing them all up. Baker Mayfield, but he wasn't a Heisman Trophy by accident.
No,
Heisman Trophy candidate by accident.
Oh no! He's an outstanding quarterback in his own right. In fact, to me, almost, you know, the better question almost would be, who would make a better NFL quarterback, Mayfield or Barrett?
Well, given Mayfield's size, I would probably have to say Barrett. You know, because he's small. As we were talking with Bill Landis, he's not a big guy.
Yeah, only 6'1".
Yeah, and that's about what, you know, you get very few guys. Russell Wilson's a 6 foot guy, 6'1 guy.
Right.
Drew Brees is a 6 foot, 6'1 guy.
And we know story on Russell Wilson at draft time. That's been erased, but we all remember, well, he's too small. That's why he went so low.
But the point is, he made it at that size.
Yep.
And is a star. And Drew Brees made it at that size and a star.
Yep.
But they are the outliers. They are not the rule. They're the exception. We talked about Johnny Manziel. I said, hey, I'm not going to disqualify Johnny Manziel from being able to play because of his height. I think guys can do that. But it just depends on, you know, what their makeup is. Baker Mayfield, maybe he'll be more like Drew Brees or Russell Wilson and be able to do that rather than the other side. But just speaking of it, as far as Saturday goes, who's your pick?
Right now, I like the Buckeyes, even though I agree with when we were had Bill Landis on last hour, and the theory is maybe Oklahoma, knowing where they're at after that loss to Houston 2 weeks ago, that they're going to have more impetus to try to get this game to not fall completely out of everything. I get
well, they
that.
They got a sense of urgency.
Thank
I mean,
you. That was what I was. That's
Saturday.
The phrase I was looking for, sense of urgency. But
they're
I just,
their season's
I have been,
over. They might as well just, you know, pack it in
yeah.
and say, well, we're done for the
They basically
year
because, have to run the table the rest of the way, including Ohio State out of conference and win the Big 12 to have any prayer, I think, at this point of the playoff. That being said, I've been thoroughly impressed with these first 2 weeks from the Buckeyes. Remember, Bob, I was the one who was saying, leading up to the Bowling Green game, which ended, 77-10 or whatever it was, I was one saying, you know, I got a feeling this game might look a lot like the Navy opener from a couple years ago, and it was anything but, and then they didn't have a subsequent letdown in the second game.
See, I disagree. That's the point. I see you say thoroughly impressed by the Buckeyes in the first two games. I was not thoroughly impressed on Saturday, as we talked about with Bill. They were sluggish. There was a 3-3 game. They didn't get an offensive touchdown until the third quarter. They were really looking like a very incomplete team, an offense that did not have that, you know, that same type of, I don't want to say chemistry, it's overused, but they were not, you know, firing on all cylinders. There's a different metaphor. The way they were against BG, they were very, very sluggish and sloppy, really, until that rain delay against Tulsa.
Yeah, and you are correct about that. That is correct. I haven't seen, outside of that first part of Tulsa that we're talking about, I haven't seen the kind of adjustment period that we saw 2 years ago when the season started, and they struggled with the Navy game and then lost to Virginia Tech. I'm not seeing that, you know, this year. And what's been the theory regarding the Buckeyes? Well, everything will be fine, you know, as they go forward. And that's why when we're talking polls, for example, oh, we may see Michigan ahead of Ohio State, you know, here in the early going, but that'll possibly be flipped by the time you get to the Michigan-Ohio State game around that, you know, at the end of the season. And
yeah.
The logic behind that was, well, Ohio State's got to work in all these new guys starting, and they got to get used to each other, and there's going to be struggles early on for a couple
yeah.
games, regardless of what opponent. And outside of the first part, before the rain delay at Tulsa, I've seen none of that. And
yeah.
that's kind of what has me impressed. We're not seeing the struggles that it took them basically three games to really get in high gear 2 years ago, even though they won the national championship that year. Outside of that first half, first part against Tulsa before the delay, I am not really seeing that this year.
Yeah, but I
which
I just,
makes me say,
I'm not
which makes me wonder where they're going to look at the end of October.
I'm not as generous as you, and I'm not as easy of a grader as you are, because you can't just say, well, outside of that, that's a lot when you've only had two games. When you've had two games, that means you've had four halves.
Right
now, that means they've played one fourth of their halves really, really poorly. 25% of what they've done was really, really poor and underperforming. That's the way I look at it. And to be quite honest with you, I'm not convinced that, save for that rain delay, that they would have been better. I mean, this might have been an ugly win over a Tulsa team, you know, that that deserved to be beaten by 40, which they were eventually, but that might have been by 12 or by 15 or even by 19. This is the way they were playing that game. I think that rain delay changed a lot of things. I think Urban Meyer went in and did what he, you know, what he can do. To paraphrase our good friend Mark Beyer, this just in, Urban Meyer can coach a little.
Yeah.
you know, I think he used that time to his advantage in a major way, and I'm not certain, to be truthful, I'm not certain that without that rain delay that they would have really kind of turned that back around and corrected all of what ailed them, you know, within that game.
And you may very well be right. We may be looking at the Bull Durham. We need a rain delay. I can get us a rain out. $50 says I can get us a rain out for tomorrow. Maybe that is exactly what was needed at that time. So maybe if there's not a delay, maybe it becomes an ugly type of game and looking like that. If in essence, before the delay, that was kind of what I expected the Buckeyes to look like a little bit in week one against Bowling Green.
Right, but I think Bowling Green, and if Bowling Green had been the Bowling Green of a year ago, and that's no diss on the kids right now, but if they'd been the Bowling Green of a year ago with Matt Johnson and Roger Lewis and that skill set, that set of skilled players is what I'm trying to say and laboring to do it. Then maybe so, but obviously this is kind of a new Ohio, our new Bowling Green team too, and they had their own, you know, struggles to work out, I guess, a little bit in the early going, and they even proved that against North Dakota State, in week number two as well.
Yeah, anyway, that was regular North Dakota, not that. North Dakota State, former home of Carson Wentz. Those are two different schools.
Different school. But having said all of that, I am actually picking the Buckeyes to win this too. I said to Bill Landis that you know, barring some really egregious disparity in talent, you go with the home team, but I think Ohio State is a more talented team. I don't think the Houston loss for Oklahoma was a fluke. And that doesn't mean I think they're going to lose a bunch of games. I think they'll probably lose that one and this one, and maybe that's it. Although they still have Bedlam to play against Oklahoma State and everything else down the line. I think Oklahoma is a very good team, but they're not as good as Ohio State. I think the Buckeyes go into Norman, and I think they win. And I think they win relatively handily. And by that, I mean, it's not going to be a field goal at the final gun. It's going to be, you know, maybe a touchdown and a field goal by 9 or 10 points. So that's what I'm calling for on Saturday. All right, that's all the time we got. But before we go, let me hook you up with our ticket sweet deal of the week: a family 4-pack of tickets, gift certificates from Splash Universe Water Park in Dundee. Just log on to 1065theticket.com tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. That's tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning, to pick up these sweet deal gift certificates to Splash Universe, a $130 value for just $35. Or be caller number 10 right now and pay $0 for those four gift certificates. 866-240-1065. Caller 10, that package of tickets is yours to Splash Universe in Dundee. Thanks again to Bill Landis and to Drew Allard for being our guests. We'll talk to you tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on the Extravaganza. Do not go anywhere, because Mr. Miller is coming up next. Drive Time right here on the Ticket.